ballot measure still is just as concerning to our group and our 400-plus coalition members as it was yesterday.
The state Supreme Court rules the Yes for Salmon initiative can go on the ballot after some tweaks. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, August 8th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the FCC commissioner learns about rural health services that use broadband.
Trying to make people fly in with their parent for a half hour, 45 minute visit every 3 months, which is not really practical.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. You know your teenager is struggling, friends have changed, grades have dropped, and when you try to talk, they argue or ignore you. Don't wait until it gets worse. Take action by calling Alaska Crossings. Alaska Crossings has helped hundreds of teens gain back their confidence and self-esteem in a full, fun, outdoor environment. The program is now accepting applications for troubled teens ages 12 to 18. Visit alaskacrossings.org and apply today. Alaska Crossings. Youth succeed here. This message sponsored by Alaska Crossings.
The Yes for Salmon initiative, or at least most of it, will be on the November ballot. The Alaska Supreme Court today ruled that only certain provisions of the controversial ballot initiative are unconstitutional. Whether the rest becomes state law will be up to Alaska voters. The initiative is aimed at ramping up protections for salmon habitat and is fiercely opposed by industry in the state. Elizabeth Harbaugh of Alaska's Energy Desk has the details.
The Alaska Supreme Court's decision guarantees a big fish fight ahead. The court ruled that only two parts of the initiative are unconstitutional because they explicitly bar the state from giving some projects a permit. That goes against a section of Alaska's Constitution, which says ballot initiatives can't prioritize one state resource, here fish, over others like mines and oil developments. So the court is ordering that those two provisions must be cut out. But the rest of the Yes for Salmon initiative is good to go. Stand for Salmon director Ryan Scriver is organizing the Yes for Salmon campaign, and he's satisfied with the outcome.
We're a little bit bummed that the Supreme Court removed a couple of provisions of the initiative, but they have left intact the heart and soul of what we were trying to do.
Lawyers for the state, who challenged Yes for Salmon in court, are also counting this as a win. That's because they weren't arguing whether the ballot initiative is a good idea or not. They just said it violated a specific part of the Alaska Constitution. Now that the Supreme Court took out the unconstitutional parts, the state's narrow legal challenge ends. Libby Bacalar is an assistant attorney general for the state and helped argue the case.
Our role as the attorneys for the Division of Elections and the Lieutenant Governor's Office is to ensure that no measure that violates Article 11, Section 7 reaches the ballot. And so we succeeded in upholding that mission today.
Yes for Salmon's opponents say the decision doesn't change how they feel about the initiative.
The ballot measure still is just as concerning to our group and our 400-plus coalition members as it was yesterday.
Katie Capozzi is the campaign manager for Stand for Alaska, a group formed to fight the initiative. Stand for Alaska is backed by the state's biggest oil, gas, and mining companies, as well as Alaska Native corporations, trade unions, and other groups. Capozzi argues even in its new form, Yes for Salmon will still have wide-reaching impacts.
We plan to march forward. We plan to still continue informing Alaskans on the negative impacts this ballot measure will have on their lives. And we're still going to encourage Alaskans to vote no on November 6th.
Stand for Alaska will be marching forward with a lot of money behind it. Recent filings with the state show the group has raised more than $9 million over the entire campaign, and that includes staff time, with big donations from companies like BP and the Pebble Limited Partnership. Yes for Salmon reports raising significantly less, just under $1 million for the entire campaign. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A top Trump administration official says the Interior Department is moving to open millions more acres in Alaska's National Petroleum Reserve to oil development. Interior Assistant Secretary of Land and Minerals Management Joe Balash delivered a speech yesterday in New Orleans at a conference hosted by the Heartland Institute. The Heartland Institute is a free market think tank known for questioning climate science. Balash, who once served as Alaska's Natural Resources Commissioner, said allowing more fossil fuel development on federal land in Alaska is one of his top priorities.
In Alaska, there are literally billions of barrels of oil and trillions, tens of trillions of cubic feet of natural gas on federal lands waiting, just waiting to be found, developed and transported to markets.
Balash said that effort includes allowing oil exploration in parts of the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska, that the Obama administration put off limits. Last year, the Interior Department decided to reevaluate that plan. Currently, it doesn't allow drilling in roughly half of the reserve. Balash said that process will likely lead to much more land being put up for oil leasing.
We're working now with the state of Alaska and the local government, the North Slope Borough, to redevelop an integrated activity plan in the region that will make millions more acres available for leasing and opening up some of the most prospective areas closest to the Barrow Arch.
Environmental groups oppose opening up more of the reserve to oil development, saying the region provides critical habitat for migratory birds and caribou. FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr stopped in Anchorage today to hear from rural health providers as part of his statewide tour of broadband systems. Commissioner Carr has already visited Unalaska and Palmer on his Alaska tour to learn about challenges with broadband internet access. As Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports, today's visit was all about telehealth services.
When someone has a health problem in a rural area like Port Graham, health aides like Tanya McMullen are generally the first line of defense.
We have three health aides, including myself. We have the health aides switch over. We take after-hour calls, so 1 week it'll be one, and another one takes it.
McMullen is video conferencing with doctors working at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. FCC Commissioner Brendan Carr is also here, learning about the ways specialized doctors in Anchorage are able to help with issues an aide like McMullen isn't trained or equipped to handle. Dr. Rachel Lesher is a pediatric endocrinologist, meaning she specializes in issues like kids' diabetes. Telehealth allows Lesher to diagnose patients who may be hundreds of miles away, off the road system.
Trying to make people fly in with their parent escort for a half hour, 45 minute visit every 3 months when it takes a day to travel here and you spend the night at a hotel and you spend the next night in a hotel and a day to travel home and they're missing 3 days of work in school, which is not really practical.
It may not seem like the Federal Communications Commission has a lot to do with healthcare, but in Alaska, they play a major role. Rural healthcare providers receive subsidies from the FCC to help pay their sometimes hefty internet bills. However, this year, the committed subsidies were less than 1% of what providers were anticipating. That resulted in some service shutdowns in rural communities like Cordova. On a shuttle ride from a tour of the South Central Foundation, Carr explained what happened.
For years, the program was undersubscribed, meaning we weren't hitting the cap on the support that we would provide through the Universal Service Program. Last year and the year before that, for the first time, we started hitting and going over that cap. And so the FCC voted a couple months ago to raise the cap so we can provide the necessary funding to support these deployments.
Carr says that raising that cap from $400 million to $571 million is one of the ways that the FCC is addressing subsidy issues. He also says that the commission is working to process the payments more effectively due to concerns from service providers that it was taking too long. Getting those subsidies will help rural health aides like Tanya McMullen continue to use telehealth services, which she says she uses frequently.
That's really nice, very helpful. It's everyday use for us.
Commissioner Carr will round out his Anchorage visit with meetings with local broadcasters before flying up to Utqiagvik and Wainwright, and later Dillingham and Point Clark. He heads back to D.C. Friday night. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A new report from the state's Division of Public Health offers a bleak outlook of Alaska's continued struggle with opioid addiction. Researchers looked at data related to abuse of prescription painkillers as well as heroin and the synthetic opioid fentanyl. The number of fatal overdoses is up for the fifth year in a row. According to preliminary data, 107 Alaskans died from opioid overdoses last year. Though the state overall is below the national average for fatal overdoses, the rates vary by region, with the highest concentration in Anchorage. One bright spot in the findings is that the rate of opioids dispensed to Medicaid patients has decreased, which the report's authors suggest could indicate more judicious prescribing practices among healthcare providers. Many people's first exposure to powerful narcotics are through legally prescribed painkillers that have a high risk of causing dependence. There's also evidence that more of the overdose-reducing medication naloxone is reaching drug users, curbing the number of fatal overdoses. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, troopers say two men charged with poaching a black bear and two cubs were caught on camera.
It shows them shoulder a rifle and taking two shots at the sow. And then the audio allows you to hear the cubs shrieking in the den.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium featured open positions include CMAs and LPNs for their primary care clinics in Southeast Alaska. Come work for Search and contribute to your community. Enjoy full benefits, paid time off, and retirement savings. Search is looking for someone like you. For more information, visit search.org/jobs. That's search.org/jobs to apply. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium.
A rescue effort for the occupants of a flight-seeing plane that crashed last weekend in Denali National Park has turned to a recovery effort and figuring out if that's even possible. A Talkeetna-based mountaineering ranger tethered to a helicopter in what's known as a short haul reached the Thunder Mountain crash site Monday. He confirmed four on board had died, with the fifth presumed dead. That ranger is Chris Erickson. Erickson says there had been a brief satellite phone call from the plane after the crash, which gave rescuers some hope that they might have a shot at saving the passengers or pilot.
We were really only able to get off the ground here in Talkeetna three times. The first time was on Saturday evening, and that was the initial search for the plane. We spent several hours and got very close. However, the site location and the ridge top were obscured in clouds. That was on Saturday. On Sunday, we had one military aircraft that was just attempting to get to the staging site, which is 4,000 feet below the crash site. And they spent about 3 or 4 hours attempting to get to that staging site, and they were unsuccessful in doing so. The weather was very low. Monday, we flew directly from Talkeetna to the crash site. And, you know, one of the main reasons we would want to short haul is for our ability to get out of there quickly. If we were landed and then down climbed to the site, clouds start coming in, we're going to get stuck there. We're not going to be able to exit fast enough. And that turned out to be true. You know, I was on the scene for 5 minutes roughly, maybe a little less. And clouds came in to the point where when we pulled out of there, the aircraft vanished in the clouds basically as I was getting pulled out.
So, Chris, basically you land at a staging area somewhat closer to the crash site, hook a rope to the helicopter, and then you hook that rope to a harness on yourself, right? Then what happens?
The short haul itself was about 4,000 vertical feet. So the staging site was around 6,500. The crash site's around 10,500. Not too far horizontal distance, but quite a bit of elevation gain.
Wait, so you're dangling below a helicopter climbing 4,000 feet up a mountainside?
Yeah, it's probably not for folks who are afraid of heights. I am a climber, so I generally feel more comfortable on the ground than I do in the air. In this particular case, it was pretty windy, so I was just trying to manage my body position and my pack position so that I didn't start, you know, flying around out of control. I was trying to make it smooth as much as I can. It took a little while. I was about 100 feet above the plane. Coming down that last 100 feet took a little while. Andy was, you know, having to go in reverse a couple of times. Actually positioning that load, you know, any helicopter pilot will tell you that it's very difficult to do. And then given all of the facts and circumstances of this particular location, a flat light at altitude on a steep terrain with a 200-foot rope, it's quite difficult. That said, Andy basically dropped me right on top of the plane. I stayed attached to the line. But then at that point, you know, as best I could, I just started excavating a small amount of snow to try to, you know, find any survivors or anybody on the plane. There was no evidence. I didn't find any evidence of any movement outside of the aircraft. Didn't see any foot tracks or anything like that. I'm yelling loudly into the plane, trying to listen for any sound. Based on what I saw when I first got there, it seemed pretty unlikely to me that there would be any survivors.
What happens now as far as recovering the bodies? It sounds like it could be a while before that can be accomplished.
Or not at all. The recovery effort at this point, basically our next step is to determine whether or not it's possible. The plan is for two of us from here in Talkeetna to fly up there basically at the next available weather window, which we don't have right now, and to spend more time the 5 minutes that I was on scene was primarily trying to figure out if anyone was still alive there. The next step would be to really look at it critically from the perspective of, can we safely operate here? There's a lot of things that can go wrong regarding the stability of the aircraft. It's not as simple as just tie ropes to it and anchor it to the mountain. The fact that it's suspended on a crevasse bridge adds a three-dimensional element to where that aircraft can go. It's definitely an avalanche slope. It's snowing there now. It might have been safe 2 days ago and not safe today, to the point where it might not be doable. And so we're doing our best to get in there, take a look at it, and figure out if it's safe to do.
Chris Erickson is a mountaineering ranger with the National Park Service based in Talkeetna. Two hunters are charged with poaching bears in Prince William Sound. Alaska State Troopers report that 41-year-old Andrew Renner and 18-year-old Owen Renner, both of Palmer, face felony and misdemeanor charges related to killing a black bear sow and two cubs in their den. The illegal harvest occurred April 14th on Esther Island. Northern Region Alaska Wildlife Trooper Commander Captain Rex Leith says the bears were part of a U.S. Forest Service and State Fish and Game study. Leith says hidden motion-triggered video and audio recorders at the den site recorded the illegal kill.
Skiing up to the den, it shows them shoulder a rifle and taking two shots at the sow. And then the audio allows you to hear the cub shrieking in the den. And then it shows the defendants obviously realizing that there's cubs, and it shows them moving closer and firing several more shots, killing the newborn cubs.
Captain Leith says the recorders also captured the Renners returning to the den site 2 days later to pick up shell casings and dispose of the dead cubs. He says the men took the sow's hide and radio collar to the Fish and Game office in Palmer and then lied about what happened.
They reported that the bear had no cubs and no cubs were seen.
Leith says the charges thus far include tampering with evidence, which is a felony, but the others related to the illegal kill are misdemeanors.
In the state of Alaska, there are very few felony charges when it relates to wildlife or fishery crimes. Now, there are some felonies such as wanton waste, but in this situation, the other acts such as shooting the cubs and shooting the bears in their den, those kind of things, those are all misdemeanor based on current state law.
Leith says additional charges could be filed if new information comes forward. A truck, boat, and rifles used in the illegal kill were seized by the state. Leith says it will be up to the court to decide whether or not the property is returned to the renters. A special election for a seat on the Anchorage Assembly appears to have a decisive winner. After a snap campaign and mail-in vote this summer, attorney Austin Quinn Davidson has an 18-point lead over her closest competitor to represent West Anchorage. The 38-year-old Quinn Davidson positioned herself as a progressive candidate in the race, attracting support from prominent liberal and democratic figures, as well as drawing donations from several union groups. At a gathering of supporters in Spinard last night, Quinn Davidson was confident her lead would hold as the final votes were tallied.
We just had such engagement on our campaign, and really I feel like this campaign was run by volunteers, and it was won by volunteers, and we just had a lot of people engaged, and I think it's because they really wanted to see me win and bring their values to the assembly.
So far, voter turnout in the unusual summer special election is just under 17%. That could go up slightly as several hundred last-minute ballots are processed by the clerk's office. Quinn Davidson currently has 49% of the vote, with conservative leading candidates Nikki Rose at 31% and Sam Moore at just under 10%. In June, a sitting assembly member representing West Anchorage resigned, citing health reasons, triggering the off-season vote to replace him. Quinn Davidson's election isn't expected to significantly change the 11-member assembly's current liberal-leaning composition or its general alignment with Mayor Ethan Berkowitz's administration.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Petersburg's recycling program is no longer saving the borough money on the cost of shipping solid waste out of town. That's because of a drop in the value of recyclable materials and an increase in the cost of processing that material. Now, borough staff are recommending the assembly start a discussion about whether to continue it or make changes. Joe Vicnicki reports.
When the borough first got into offering curbside commingled recycling collection in 2016, it was good for the borough's bottom line and for the environment. Petersburg Public Works Director Chris Cotta updated the borough assembly this week.
When the curbside program was implemented, the commodity prices at the time were good, and so for a couple of years, the program was doing really well.
For those years, it cost the community less to ship out a ton of recycled goods than a ton of garbage. But that's changed. The value of many of the items sent to the recycling center in Seattle has dropped, and recycling companies are charging more to process it. The bottom line is it now costs the borough more for shipping a ton of recyclables versus a ton of garbage. Cotta thought the assembly and the community should be having a discussion on whether to continue with the service.
With the program losing money right now, the community really needs to decide, how committed are we to recycling? Do we want to possibly continue with something that's going to, be costing money long term? Does the community care about recycling that much that we're committed to that level? Or would we rather, phase out the program or change the program to a different format?
Other options could be changing back to drop-off points for gathering recyclables instead of curbside collection, or reducing the types of material collected. Cotta said some products like cardboard and aluminum have kept their value. He also suggested a focus on composting could reduce the amount of trash shipped out. Petersburg contracts to ship a combined 2,400 tons of trash and recyclables off the island each year, with about 300 tons of that material that can be reused and spared from the landfill. With the current rates and values, the borough would save about $3,300 a year in its garbage contract alone to send the recyclables instead to the landfill. It would also save money on the vehicles and employee time for the recycling program. The program is paid for by the residential and business customers of the sanitation utility. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
An artist from Los Angeles recently spent a week in Togiak to learn how people have lived off the land and thrived in the region. Her goal is to promote conservation of Alaska's wilderness. KDLG's Austin Fast reports.
Artist Lindsay Karen has her hands full in Togiak as she sketches out a beach landscape on a shipping container in front of the village's senior center. Kids can't help but get drawn in.
I'll call them packs of children because they kind of ramble around town like packs of wolves. and they would come and circle by and get curious and then come back and want to help.
Karen gives the kids total artistic freedom over parts of the containers. They take full advantage of their space by splashing swatches of color and scrawling their initials across it. Their creativity literally spills over on the nearby rocks lining the path to the senior center. Karen's painting in Togiak as artist in residence with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. She's traveled all over Alaska to wildlife refuges in the Arctic and Yukon Delta to find artistic inspiration. This summer's trip to Togiak National Wildlife Refuge aims to bridge cultures and learn more about how Alaska Native people have subsisted there for so long.
It's kind of that important time to really listen to what they have to say in regards to conservation, especially because they are the people who have been living in balance with these places for thousands of years, and I find it really important to listen to their voices right now.
Karen ate lots of salmon alongside families from the 800-person village. She hiked on the tundra and floated upriver on a village-sponsored trip with kids learning about local subsistence traditions. This big city artist says Togiak taught her a great deal she hopes to convey through the art she'll finish in the coming months.
Coming up to these villages just allows me to take it day by day and slow down and breathe and be fully present with every experience. I really cherish learning from Native family and how much importance they place on family time and coming together and honor and respect of their elders.
Karen says she hopes to work with other wildlife refuges in future summers so she can tell more Alaskan stories through art to people down south. In Togiak, I'm Austin Fast.
The St. Herman pilgrimage is Thursday. St. Herman was the first canonized Orthodox saint in North America and is said to have brought Orthodoxy to the continent through Kodiak. In preparation for the pilgrimage, Kodiak's Orthodox Church has put together a schedule of events, including a banquet, a tea with the Bishop of Alaska, and multiple services. One such service kicked off pilgrimage week yesterday evening in the Holy Resurrection Cathedral. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
Bells toll for the beginning of the service, and people are still arriving. They cluster in the front of the cathedral, not wanting to take up too much of the space just inside, where people stand facing the priests. This service kicks off the celebration of St. Herman's life.
Pilgrimages are pretty common in Orthodoxy.
That's Alaska Bishop David Mahaffey, who's flown in from Anchorage expressly for the journey to Spruce Island, where St. Herman lived in the 19th century when he was still a monk and not yet a saint. Bishop David says St. Herman was canonized in 1970.
It was only natural that someone of this character and this caliber is worthy of sainthood and worthy to be remembered and emulated by us. So we all kind of try to be, if you will, St. Herman in our own way.
Bishop David explains people come from all over the world to celebrate the date of St. Herman's canonization. During the pilgrimage, they visit where St. Herman lived and is said to have performed miracles, like stopping a tsunami in its path. Father Innocent Dresdo is pastor of Holy Resurrection Cathedral in Kodiak and guides pilgrims to Spruce Island by boat. He says the journey is a time to strengthen one's faith. Father Innocent describes Spruce Island as mystical.
When they walk up the trail after getting off the boat, there's a point where you hear the ocean. And the waves are just crashing on the shoreline. And it's that wonderful, beautiful sound we're all so familiar with living here on an island. But you go up over a ridge and suddenly it's replaced with the quiet of the forest. And it's quieter there than anywhere I've ever been in the world.
Boats leave the city of Kodiak for Spruce Island at 9 a.m. on Thursday, August 9th. Once there, they'll perform the Divine Liturgy and return to the city between 2 and 4 p.m. that same day. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, Austin Fast in Togiak, and Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.